Hi, everybody. Cheryl Atkison here. Welcome to another edition of the Cheryl Atkison Podcast. Today, breast cancer surgeon and specialist Dr. Kathleen Ruddy talks about how medicine dropped the ball on research about the breast cancer virus and how she's trying to inspire someone to pick up that research.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In this age of a highly controlled media landscape, it's never been more important to fight the heavy hand of censorship and support truly independent journalism. Go to CherylAtkison.com and click on the store tab for a great way to do that. There are all kinds of fun and functional products designed specifically for independent and free thinkers like you, featuring slogans like, "I tested positive for critical thinking," and "I need to find some new conspiracy theories, all my old ones came true." Proceeds support independent journalism causes like the ION Awards for off-narrative accurate reporting. Go to CherylAtkison.com and click the store tab today. I think you're going to find today's interview as fascinating as I did. Dr. Kathleen Ruddy is a breast cancer specialist, a breast cancer surgeon, and author of a book, The End of Breast Cancer, A Virus and the Hope for a Vaccine. Yes, you heard correctly, a breast cancer virus, which sounds so wild at first until you think about, we already know that some types of cancers are caused by HPV, a virus. And Dr. Ruddy told me, as you will hear, that a breast cancer virus in animals was studied and discovered decades ago. But, she says, researchers dropped the ball and quit looking at the question of a breast cancer virus and how much of the cancer we see in women today might be because of a virus that is spread perhaps through sexual transmission or breast milk or even kissing. We don't know because the research, as she says, was never finished. Besides talking about that, we're going to start off talking about something else. She is also principal investigator of an observational study looking at repurposed medications in the treatment of patients with cancer. This means looking at medications that are already proven safe and effective for other purposes that are already on the market being sold that may show benefits in terms of treating cancer. What I like about Dr. Ruddy, and I've interviewed quite a few of these doctors and medical specialists in the last couple of years. She's one of those independent doctors that came up very much through mainstream medicine. She is world-renowned and respected, but she, like many others, questioned the wisdom of how the medical establishment has approached many of our illnesses and problems in recent years. And she's among a large group that are sort of breaking away from some of the traditional thought and deciding that we need to look at some other avenues, maybe do some research that's being ignored by the big institutions and the government funders, or consider medicines for things that they're not normally considered for because they don't make people a lot of money because the medicines have gone generic in nature. In any of it, I think we owe a lot to these types of doctors and scientists stepping in and trying to do things and answer questions that our medical establishment have failed to answer and in some cases are failing to even ask. So here is Dr. Kathleen Ruddy. What is the upshot of that study on the repurposed medicine for cancer?
Well, the objective is to answer the question, does ivermectin or other repurposed medications, so do these repurposed FDA-approved medications improve the survival of patients with cancer? That's the question. The study is designed to answer that question.
And how did you... Is the study being conducted now, or do you have results already?
No, the study has just been launched with the leadership of the FLCCC. Dr. Paul Merrick is the lead investigator of the study, so it's just been launched. It's going to be multi-center study, so we have six principal investigators, co-investigators with Dr. Merrick, and we'll begin to enroll patients and then collect the data on the patients who have cancer and who have elected themselves to take either Mectin or other repurposed medications, and we'll follow them over a period of time to see whether or not there is a survival benefit to those patients compared to historical controls. So we have years, decades of historical controls. We'll be able to see what happens with the patients who are taking these repurposed medications in order to answer the question, do they live longer?
It might seem obvious to you, but just to kind of say it out loud, What is the thought behind why to do this study?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. Why would you even have this as a thought? Yeah. And so it turns out that frontline critical care doctors who pioneered the use of a repurposed medication, ivermectin, for the treatment of COVID and long COVID and vaccine injury have encouraged us to consider repurposed medications for the treatment of diseases that were not originally assigned as indications. And one of the potential uses of ivermectin and other antiparasitics, drugs like metformin, sildenafil, Atorvastatin, quite a long list. Turns out, much to my surprise, at least, and I think the surprise of others, is that we have 20 years of scientific research, bench work, laboratory work, published in peer-reviewed journals, and it converges and compels us to move forward with a proper investigation of these drugs in humans. So if we look at the impact of, say, ivermectin or mebendazole on cancer cell lines, so over the course of 50-odd years, we've been able to take cells from patients who have tumors, and we can now grow them in the laboratory. The HeLa cells, which were the first of those cells taken from Henrietta Lacks, cervical cancer cells, have been really foundational in our understanding of malignant disease and so forth. But there are at least 30 other human cell lines, lung cancer, colon cancer, melanoma, breast, prostate, whatever. And so we have these cells, these cancer cells, grown in the labs all over the world. And scientists have been able to then expose these cells and implant these cells into animals and recreate these tumors in animals, breast cancer in mice being very common, animals model, and then test all kinds of things, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, monoclonal antibody, your favorite drug, including ivermectin, mebendazole, metformin, all the rest of it. And what they discovered over a period of 20 years is that ivermectin works against pretty much every single one of these cancer cell lines. So you expose the cancer cell or the animal that's growing that particular cancer to antiparasitic medications, and what happens? Well, the cancer stops growing, doesn't grow as fast, goes away. And so 20 years of research sitting in the laboratory and parked permanently in the laboratory, it would seem, is not doing cancer patients very much good, is it? Well, why would all of that converging and compelling scientific data just be permanently parked in long-term storage in the peer-reviewed literature and in the laboratory? Because these medications are off patent. They've been off patent for decades. And you're not going to make any money. As a matter of fact, you're going to lose money. In order to launch a clinical trial for a repurposed medication, a drug company has to lay out about $6 million, a lot of money. And you're not going to get a dime back because it costs 10 cents a pill. Ivermectin, mebendazole, metformin, all the rest of it. And so the challenge for us recently, who became aware of this, Dr. Merrick and Dr. Corey and others, including myself, was how are we going to move this flat, stalled information out of the lab and into a human study so that we can evaluate. It looks really good in the lab. How about in the clinic? Does it work in the clinic? There are a lot of anecdotal reports, that is, just people telling their stories. I took it. I took fenbendazole and my cancer is gone. I took ivermectin, my cancer is gone. That's great. Could be true. Possibly, based on the laboratory research, it would seem plausible. But we cannot move science forward by just posting on Facebook, okay, or sharing our stories on TikTok. So we had to try and understand what could we do to move the ball downfield. And we came up with the idea of doing an observational study, which is where you begin anyway. You begin with observations. And if we as the principal investigators are not prescribing the medication, the patients are choosing to take these medications and they are getting these medications from licensed providers and these are FDA-approved drugs, the patient is deciding that he or she wants to try, say, ivermectin either as part of their standard treatment or subsequent to their treatment because they're out of treatments, or instead of patient choice. And we're going to follow them. We're merely going to record that these patients are enrolled in the study. We have a well-designed, thoughtful questionnaire. We'll be querying them on a regular basis, collecting the data, patient protected, and analyzing the data independently. So I won't be looking at the patients in my study and saying, oh, hey, guess what? You know, I've got 83%, whatever. Yeah, no, all of the data are going to be channeled and husbanded by FLCCC, Dr. Merrick. And we have independent biostatistician with the highest credentials who'll be evaluating the data. And once we have sufficient data over a sufficient period of time, we will then review it and ask the question again that we asked at the beginning when we launched the study, which is, are these patients living longer than they would have if they did not take these medications?
Stay with us after a short break, the little-known breast cancer virus.
Introducing Whipped Seafoam Body Butter by Sirenae Cosmetics. Hi, I'm Star, owner of the Lemonade Mermaid. Enriched with the nourishing powers of cocoa butter, mango butter, and shea butter, our body butter whisks you away to a world of deep hydration. Experience the essence of the sea with every application as this whipped delight leaves your skin refreshed, replenished, and ready to conquer the day. Visit thelemonademermaid.com and make your skin sing with the magic of the sea.
Can you talk about breast cancer as caused potentially by a virus and explain that in simple terms, if possible?
Sure. So we know that cervical cancer is caused by a virus, right? HPV. Most people know that. But what does that actually mean? Because I think a lot of times people know things that they don't understand, right? So let's try and understand why a virus would cause a cancer. Viruses contain code. They're just code. They're just genetic code, and they're packaged. And they don't have a way to get around on their own. So they just blow around, or they get washed around. You sneeze them. You acquire them through contact. In the case of HPV, it would be sexual contact. So now the virus is bumped into you. And once the virus is bumped into you and can get into your body, so HPV can get into your body with sexual intercourse and then land on your cervix, the virus has a way to get into the cells of the cervix. Also has a way to get into the cells of the head and neck, but let's just talk about the cervix. And let's just pause for a moment to think that the influenza virus, you bump into that and it gets into your lungs, right? And the hepatitis virus gets into your liver. So we say that viruses have their target organs. Okay. So now a particular virus gets into the cervix, gets into the cells of the cervix, and when it gets inside the cell, the packaging, the capsule, whatever, you know, falls apart. It's like a Christmas gift. Unwrap the gift. And the genetic code makes its way into the nucleus, which is where your genetic code is kept. Your genetic code. Everything about you is kept in that genetic blueprint for Cheryl. The virus gets in, and a tumor virus has a mechanism by which it can introduce itself permanently into your genetic code. So your genetic code, your genome, we call it, is no longer just making Cheryl's hair and her eyes and her skin. No. It's now making Cheryl and more tumor virus. Some of these tumor viruses are able to transform the cell from a normal cervical cell into a malignant cervical cell, which will grow indefinitely, immortally. The title of the book about Henrietta Lacks is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. So malignantly transformed cells, as a result of this viral infection, will replicate forever. They will also acquire the ability to move from the cervix around the body. They can go to the lymph nodes, they can go to the lungs, they can go to the liver. And they'll just keep doing that until they're stopped. So that's HPV, that's cervical cancer. There's a vaccine that prevents cervical cancer. Why? Because the vaccine defends your body from that virus. No virus, no cervical cancer. You take the virus out of the equation, and you don't get the cervical cancer. Wonderful. There are many tumor viruses, many. They don't get talked about very much because they used to be talked about a lot. The National Cancer Institute had a very large, what they call, study section devoted to tumor viruses. The majority of the work that was being done at the NCI on tumor viruses came to a screeching halt once the National Cancer Act was passed, because the National Cancer Act promised to end cancer in 5 years. We're going to cure it. We're going to cure it in 5 years. Who cares what causes it? We're going to cure it. And so that entire study section...
When was that?
1973, I think. So 100 years of research on tumor viruses. Many of the scientists, researchers, including James Holland, whose life's work moved from leukemia, lymphoma, to the breast cancer virus, he testified before Congress in the run-up to the National Cancer Act. And the senators and their aides, and we know about the breast cancer virus, and we know about tumor viruses, blah, blah, blah. But that was the end of it, because, you know what, we're going to cure cancer in 5 years. Okay. So the breast cancer virus, which was discovered in mice by John Bittner in 1936, was found to be passed from mothers to their offspring, both male and female, in breast milk. It was also found to be spread by the males in sexual intercourse. Just fascinating. Well, that was a little bit alarming, even in 1936, because the implication was, well, if the breast cancer virus is being passed in breast milk in mice, is it being passed in breast milk in humans? And John Bittner was very circumspect in answering that question. And there was a lot of pushback at the time, particularly by Clarence Cook, who was running the lab, Jackson Memorial Lab, where Bittner was working, and Bittner discovered the breast cancer virus at Jackson Memorial Laboratory with Clarence Cook being the director. Clarence Cook knew exactly what the results of those experiments were, which were brilliant, and John Bittner was nominated for the Nobel Prize twice before he died at a very young age. Clarence Cook then moved and became the president of what was a long name for a cancer society, and Albert Lasker, who helped his wife launch the National Cancer Act. Albert Lasker was a great marketer, and he renamed this society the American Cancer Society. So when Clarence Cook went to the American Cancer Society, he ignored the fact that there was possibly a breast cancer virus. No, because why? He believed that all cancers were caused by genetic mutations. It was the genes. Never mind the virus. It's the genes. Okay, well, welcome to science. Okay, the virus targets the ducts in the breast. It also targets the seminal vesicles in men. And once the virus gets into the cells in the breast, specifically the ductal epithelium, the ducts of the breast, you know, invasive ductal carcinoma in situ. The ducts of the breast, the virus gets into these little female pups, finds its way to the ducts of the breast and sits there and waits for the female mice to mature because the virus responds to estrogen. So the males get the virus because they breastfeed from the mother and they get the virus, and it goes into their breast epithelium, right, the ducts in the breast, but they don't grow breasts because they don't make estrogen. Okay. The female mice do. So during puberty, and especially during pregnancy, when the breasts are growing, when the breast tissue grows, when a cell that harbors a virus grows and it divides and multiplies, every cell contains the virus. And if over time that virus is stimulated by estrogen as it is, and it has the ability to transform a normal cell into a cancer cell, it does. And so this is what Bittner saw. Mice that got breast cancer, breastfeeding their pups, over a period of time, the female pups matured and they got breast cancer. They had their pups pass the virus on, and so it goes. So that breast cancer virus, at the time called the mammary tumor virus, mouse occurred in mice, mammary, the breast tumor virus, was then found in rats, dogs, cats, monkeys, and then it was found in humans.
When was that, approximately?
I'll have to look. I think the first paper where it was reported, Beatrice Pogo and James Holland were working together at Mount Sinai. I think it was Beatrice Pogo's paper in 1995 that was pretty definitive, that showed this virus, this exact virus, hadn't changed much except it was able to adapt between species. It was able to move from mice to rats, to dogs, to cats, whatever. That exact virus, Beatrice Pogo was able to find unequivocally in human breast cancer. And James Holland found it as well. I discovered it years after I had finished my fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering, never heard about the breast cancer virus. And when I first became aware of it, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, I did my fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering. I'm like a breast cancer expert. Why didn't I know about this? I'm looking at my textbooks, I'm looking in textbooks of pathology. I can find nothing about this. And then I go into the peer-reviewed scientific literature, and Holland's paper, which came out a little bit later, and Beatrice Pogo's paper, and I'm like, there's 100 years worth of research on the breast cancer virus? Why has this not moved forward? And that got me looking throughout the history of the whole discovery, and really I sort of crashed into the wall of the launch of the National Cancer Act and realized that that was the end of research on the breast cancer virus.
Okay, a couple of like quick follow-ups I had along the way. I was trying to save them. Is there some thought as to what proportion of breast cancer could be caused by virus?
There's a spectrum. There was a fascinating study. I wish I could remember the date. Not long ago, let's leave it at that, within the past 10 years, where researchers looked for evidence of the breast cancer virus in humans in saliva, because we knew from the studies, Bittner studies, that not only was it passed in breast milk and in seminal fluid, it was passed in saliva. And so these researchers looked for evidence of the breast cancer virus in newborns, okay? Brand new babies, no evidence of the virus, none. Then they looked at young children, and there was no evidence of the breast cancer virus, you know, around grade school, when children would be coming in contact with one another. There was a bit of an increase over childhood, you know, as the children progressed. They saw an increased evidence of the existence of the breast cancer virus. Then there was, very interesting, some evidence that at around adulthood, the number of people showing evidence of this breast cancer virus decreased. So there were people who were clearing the virus. They had acquired it, no problems, no overt infection, no tumors, and that at some point a certain percentage of them were able to get rid of it. Welcome to the immune system. Beautiful thing. Women who were then diagnosed with non-invasive breast cancer had a much higher evidence of the existence of this breast cancer virus infection. Women with invasive cancer, women with benign tumors had a bit higher evidence of infection. James Holland reported the last report that I was aware of when I ran into him at the American Association of Cancer Research. He had very good data, and women with stage 4 breast cancer, he had found evidence of the virus, active evidence of this virus in 94% of women with metastatic breast cancer.
Does this mean that, this may sound like a stupid question, does this mean that women can catch breast cancer?
Yeah.
From?
Well, that's a good question. Where do you get it? So, you know, we know that the mice got it from their mothers, or they got it indirectly from their sexual partners. The research was headed in the direction of answering these questions. If the breast cancer virus exists in women, and there certainly seems to be compelling evidence that it does, how are women getting it? Are they getting it because they acquired it because their mothers breastfed them? Are they getting it through as sexual transmission? Are they getting it, you know, one person, a kissing disease? How are they getting the virus? It's a question that needs to be answered. There's a lot of research that's left to do to answer the question, does a virus cause breast cancer in women? We can answer that question. If we chose to answer that question, we could answer that question.
What are the implications if a virus does cause breast cancer in women?
Well, I think there are a lot of possible interventions. One would be to screen for it. One would be to develop a proper vaccine that was properly tested and evaluated and found to be truly safe and effective, and implemented in such a way that we could protect women from the virus to the extent that we can protect everyone from certain viruses, so we know smallpox vaccine really works. We know that. We know measles vaccines really work. We've got to make them so that they're safe, but based on principle, we can make them so that they can protect you from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that a viral infection imparts.
And then lastly, clearly you're raising awareness of this, but is there any specific steps that you're taking or that you think should be taken other than, obviously, as you said, this should be research, but what can be done in the short term?
Nothing can be done in the short term until we complete the job of the research. There's only really one step left to complete the research, and that is to do a prospective study. Prospective is we're going to start here today, okay, Saturday, and we're going to move forward and we're going to look at a large number of women. You keep following the patients over a period of time and you identify those women who've become infected with the virus. And then you follow them and you see whether or not they have an increased risk of breast cancer compared to all of the other women that you're following who have no evidence of the breast cancer virus infection. And if you find, and this is how they prove that HPV causes cervical cancer, by the way, if you find that the women who became infected with the virus have an increased risk of breast cancer, that's the last step. All the other six steps have been done to prove that the virus causes breast cancer in women. You just need to do that. Well, so you need to do that, okay? Who's going to do that? Well, I think that the National Cancer Institute should do that. And in fact, the National Cancer Institute, Bob Callahan's lab, at least until several years ago, I don't know if he's still there, he's working on this, but we really need to, I mean, it's breast cancer, for crying out loud. It's the number one cause of cancer in women, right? You can't break free of all of that money that you're sloshing around and spend money to answer the question, to do the last evaluation to prove that this virus causes breast cancer in women. You can't do that? You're not giving me a good reason why you can't do that.
Today, our information landscape is marred by propaganda and corruption, much of it influenced by the pharmaceutical, government, media complex. And there's evidence it's impacting our health in a major way. Since you're listening to this podcast, I know you're an independent thinker, and you're going to love hearing what I've learned about how it works, who's behind it, and what you can do. In my new book, Follow the Science, How Big Pharma Misleads, Obscures, and Prevails. You can order from the bookstore of your choice or at HarperCollins or Amazon. Look for Follow the Science by Cheryl Akison. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast and that if you did, you'll leave us a great review, subscribe, and share it with your friends. Check out my other podcast, Full Measure After Hours. And now you can support independent journalism causes by visiting CherylAkison.com and clicking on the store tab. There are some thought-provoking and fun products designed exclusively for independent and free thinkers like you, such as products with the slogan, I need to find some new conspiracy theories. All my old ones came true. Proceeds benefit independent reporting causes. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself. Thank you.